And then I heard these footsteps in my kitchen. I didn't dare move. I hardly dared breathe. It could have been me, couldn't it?
What is it, Paul?
It's someone's hand.
It's someone's hand.
She must have had a weak heart, poor old girl. I had to stop her screaming, but I didn't mean to kill the old girl. You know what it is when a woman screams.
Murder Most Foul. 6 forensic murder cases presented by Nick Ross. Case 2, The Body in the Chalk Pit.
There is no such thing as an ordinary murder. All murders are, by their very nature, extraordinary. But some, more so than others. A murder in which the prime suspect is himself a former Minister of Justice, well, that is exceptional. But add to that a forensic scientist who changes sides in the middle of the case, from prosecution to defense, and the whole thing becomes bizarre. Our story begins at a chalk pit near Woldingham in Surrey, one chilly autumn morning in 1946. Dr. Keith Simpson had been called in as a consultant, and now he and the local police sergeant watched as the Surrey pathologist, Eric Gardner, examined a body lying in a shallow trench.
I'd call his face plum-coloured. Wouldn't you, Dr. Simpson?
Well, that's what I'd call it. And he's been dead, what, 60 hours? And the trench?
Probably dug by troops a few years back. But that's new earth there behind him.
So someone started to bury the body and then got scared.
You think so, Detective Sergeant?
Well, it seems likely. Now, why aren't his shoes covered in wet clay like ours? It's a quagmire, but he's got clean shoes.
And his jacket, his waistcoat and his shirt all wrapped up over his shoulders.
So he probably wasn't killed here. He was dragged here after he died.
I'd go along with that.
Now, that's a funny sort of noose, wouldn't you say? Loose enough for him to have pulled it off over his head.
If his hands were free.
Yeah, of course.
And the cloth. What's a dirty old piece of cloth doing tangled up with a noose?
Who knows? But every little thing helps.
It smells of polish. Yeah, well, I think we'd better get him back to the mortuary.
And back at the mortuary at Oxted, Dr. Simpson once more looked on, this time as Eric Gardner performed the post-mortem.
Asphyxiation, without a doubt.
Agreed.
Darkened skin and hemorrhages on the face and neck, cyanotic congestion of all the organs, further hemorrhages in the lungs, the brain...
The rope mark round the neck. It's not horizontal.
No.
It comes off, under the ear. Now, if he'd been strangled, it would have gone straight across the neck, wouldn't it? But he wasn't. He was hung.
Yes, I believe you're right.
So, other physical injuries?
Some small abrasions, bruising.
Trivial.
And 2 fractured ribs.
But nothing on his clothes. Or on his hands. Nothing to indicate any sort of struggle. And the injuries he does have could well have come from an accident. Say he hung himself from the first time the rope broke. And strangling, I've never known that to be other than murder. But hanging, well, why go to the trouble of hanging someone when you can strangle them? No, 9 times out of 10, hanging's self-inflicted. Either suicide or some weird sort of exercise that's gone very wrong.
You mean self-suspension for sexual pleasure?
It has been known. Either way, whether he meant to do away with himself or not, I think the evidence points to his having hanged himself. Yes?
Well, I'd say that's fair.
And then, well, either somebody else found him and cut him down.
And put him in the trench? Why?
I don't know. But anyway, maybe whoever it was then got scared and ran off, or perhaps he managed to get himself down.
Yeah, but the nearest trees to that bit are a good 30 or 40 yards.
Managed to get himself down, staggered as far as the trench, but then died anyway.
Sounds unlikely.
Certainly, but possible.
So the police searched the nearby trees. They found nothing. But at least in the dead man's pockets, they found an identity card with a name on it. John McMain Mudy. Mudy worked at Reigate Hill Hotel, some 12 miles from the chalk pit. His rooms were searched, and no signs of any sexual perversion were found. The only items of any interest there were a couple of letters asking that some checks be returned. Then, on the Monday, 4 days after Mudy's death, 2 landscape gardeners came into Woldingham police station.
You'd better come this way.
We just read about the murder.
It was a murder, wasn't it?
And we thought, well, we ought to come and see you. You see, we were cycling past the chalk pits last Wednesday.
Last Wednesday?
Yes. It's very steep there. It's very steep. So we got off and we were pushing the bikes and we saw this car.
A Ford it was. Dark-coloured saloon.
It was near the entrance. But then we saw there was this man standing up by the pits themselves. We stopped and looked at him because it's a bit unusual.
But as soon as he saw us, he bolted down the slope and got in his car.
He looked sort of excited about something, or nervous. He tried to reverse the car 3 or 4 times before he got out.
And would you know this man again?
Oh, I should think so. Don't you, Fred?
And the car. You didn't notice the number plate, did you?
Oh, we both remember the ending of it. It ended 101.
Now, this was 2 days before the likely time of John Moody's death. Was it unconnected? Or was a grave being reconnoitred, ready for a future victim's body? Then the letters found in Moody's room led the investigation suddenly into high society. To be precise, into the drawing room of one Thomas John Lay, former Minister of Justice of New South Wales, Australia, now resident in Kensington, West London.
Mr. Lay.
Yes?
My name's Detective Sergeant Shoebridge. I'd like to...
Ah, yes, you called earlier. I do come in.
I'm making inquiries regarding these two letters.
And which might... Oh, yes, those.
Both sent to a Mr. Jack Moody by your solicitors, apparently on your instructions, requesting the return of some checks. Could you tell me about them, please, sir?
But what's it all about?
Mr. Moody has been found dead. Would you care to make a statement about matters leading up to the letters being sent and stating what the outcome was?
Well, yes, I'm quite prepared to do that. You see, I'm the chairman of Canoe Properties, and one of the co-directors is a Mrs. Byron Brooke.
Yes.
I needed Mrs. Brooke's signature and some checks for salaries and expenses. I knew Mrs. Brooke was spending some time looking after her daughter's flat while she was away. But I wasn't sure whether Mrs. Brooke had yet gone on holiday herself.
Yeah, but why should you...
Well, I understood that she knew this Mr. Moody, who was lodging in the same building. So I sent the checks to him, with a letter asking him to hand the checks to Mrs. Brooke, or, if she had already left, to forward them on to her.
I see.
Later, I learned from Mrs. Brooke that she had not received the checks. So I had my solicitors write the letters you're now holding. In fact, Mr. Moody had by this time given the checks to Mrs. Brooke's son-in-law. The checks were recovered, and as far as I am concerned, that was the end of the matter.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lay. Now, do you think we could just get that down on paper?
The explanation may sound plausible at first, but why send unsigned checks through the post to a director to be passed on by a complete stranger? In any case, if Mrs. Brooke couldn't easily be found, why not get the signature from another of the co-directors? The case was now taken over by Detective Superintendent Roberts, who was in charge of Surrey's CID, and he in turn called up help from Scotland Yard. Help arrived in the shape of Detective Chief Inspector Arthur Philpott, a wily man of great experience. Roberts and Philpott quietly investigated the background of Lay, the former Minister of Justice. Some of his business deals seemed decidedly unsavoury, and it soon became apparent that Lay's relationship with Mrs. Brooke had not been restricted to business. For many years she'd been his mistress. The Detective Chief Inspector decided he must call upon the lady.
I wonder if you could tell me about your relationship with Thomas Lay, Mrs. Brooke.
I'm a co-director of his company.
But it is well known that for a long time you've been on a more intimate footing.
Well, yes. In fact, it was because of him that I came back from Australia. We'd been together over there. But why do you want to know this?
You still see a lot of each other, do you?
Yes. We have dinner together most nights.
You knew Mr. Jack Moody, didn't you?
A little. I only met him the once. I know he's died. Dreadful.
And Mr. Lay obviously knew you knew him.
Yes. He was actually...
Yes?
Well, he was a little bit jealous, but it didn't mean anything. I mean, he was jealous of anyone. Lots of men are like that, aren't they?
Jealous of anyone, you say?
Hmm.
Who else has he been jealous of, Mrs. Brooke?
Once he thought I was being familiar with my own son-in-law, woman of my age. Well, you see what I mean, he's just a little bit silly, most of the time.
Philpott spoke to others who knew the two of them, and it was confirmed that despite their both now being in their late 60s, he was still intensely jealous, continually accusing her of infidelities. It seemed more than a bit of silliness. In fact, it may be a motive for murder.
But you don't believe it was murder, Dr. Simpson?
There's no way of knowing that at this stage. Certainly, I would say that the medical...
Which now includes photographs of Moody's neck, showing that the noose was tightened before it was lifted.
But in my view, Detective Chief Inspector, that does not increase the likelihood of this being a murder. The medical evidence would not support such a charge.
And Dr. Gardner, do you agree?
Well, there is some evidence that Mudy might have been roughed up, which, of course, would mean someone else being involved. There are bruises on the head and hip.
But we agree.
And it's possible that the hemorrhages in the brain might not have been the result of asphyxiation. They could have arisen out of concussion caused by the injury to the forehead.
But that injury wasn't even visible on the skin.
And the congestion of the stomach and small intestine could well have been from a blow to the abdomen.
But there's no injury to the abdomen wall.
Please, Dr. Simpson.
And personally, I've never seen a suicide hang himself with a noose tied in a single half hitch. And neither have I ever seen, in a case of self-hanging, evidence, as in this case, of prolonged, slow asphyxia.
Well, all I can say is that my experience has been quite the contrary.
Well, think a bit about Lay. He has this mistress, he's jealous of her.
Despite that,
if he is still jealous, sexually jealous, when the woman concerned is pushing 70, then that might indicate a certain instability of mind, which certainly doesn't make murder any less likely. But Lay's physically not a strong man. Mudy is young and fit, so Lay may have needed some help. And whoever helped him may still not know that Mudy is dead. We just might scare him into coming forward. All right, so now we give the newspapers a photograph and a name and see what happens.
The results were almost immediate. Within hours of the newspapers being on the streets, an ex-boxer named Buckingham presented himself at Scotland Yard.
And what do you have to tell us, Mr. Buckingham?
Well, this Mr. Mudy that was found dead,
yeah.
Mr. Lay that lives at Beaufort Gardens, he paid me £200 to kidnap Mr. Mudy. He told me there was these two ladies that Mudy was blackmailing, a mother and a daughter, and he wanted to get him to sign something to stop him doing it and then make him leave the country.
Well, carry on.
Well, that's all on you, or I didn't know nothing about it. Lay said they'd both been seduced by some man in Wimbledon, and Mudy was blackmailing them.
So what did Mr. Lay
And there was another man, a Mr. Smith. He told me that he knew Mr. Lay because he'd worked at his ace as a builder's foreman. Well, we had a number of meetings, mostly at the Royal Hotel.
You, Lay, and this Smith man?
Yes. And eventually Mr. Lay said he'd got enough evidence on the man, Mudy, to make him sign a confession. And he wanted him brought up to London and left with him to sign this confession.
So how did you get him there?
Mrs. Bruce, a lady friend of mine, she was pretend she was having a cocktail party in London. My son was to act as chauffeur and go and collect Mr. Mudy, who was asked to come up and be the barman for this cocktail party, because that was his line of work, you see.
And that's what happened, was it? You brought him up from Reigate to London?
Yes.
So, apart from Lay, there was yourself involved, this Mrs. Bruce, and your son, and Smith.
Yes. Him and me went in another car, because my son didn't know the road, and we had to lead the way back.
In Smith's car?
Yes.
And what sort of car was it, Mr. Buckingham?
Well, it was a little Ford. A Ford 10.
Might that Ford perhaps have a number that ended in 101? Smith was soon found, and when pressed, came out with a story which, in most respects, matched Buckingham's, but with some interesting additions.
You don't mind us calling on you like this, I hope, Dr. Simpson?
Of course not.
Only some new evidence has come to light, and I just wanted to talk it over with Dr. Gardner and yourself.
Fire away.
Well, we've now got a complete statement from Smith. We told you about Smith.
The other man that Lay hired?
Yes. Well, he says that when they arrived at Beaufort Gardens, Mudy was let in. Smith and Buckingham were waiting for him, one with a rug, the other with rope. They threw the rug over Mudy's head and immediately tied him up. Then, here you are. I tied the rope in the middle of his back. Buckingham helped him along the passage by jumping him. And at the door of the room we were going to take him to, he fell forward with Buckingham on top of him. Buckingham picked him up and helped him into the room. And then he talks about that polisher's rag, you remember? Used that as a gag. Well, at least at this stage.
You see, that fall in the passage with the rug over his head explains why there's no surface indication of the bruise in the middle of his forehead. And if Buckingham fell on top of him, his knee could have hit Mudy in the abdomen, which might explain the hemorrhages in the stomach and the small intestine. So the beating up could have been accidental.
Or it might not have happened at all.
No, what Dr. Gardner is saying...
If you'll excuse me for saying so, I think Dr. Gardner's been trying a little too hard to fit the medical evidence to whatever is the latest verbal evidence.
Well, it's not unreasonable to try to find some relationship between the two, is it?
But it's not our job. It's the job of the police. And in my view, it is often dangerous for us to attempt it. Surely we should reach deductions on the basis of the medical evidence alone, then present that to the police and let them make what they will of it. And if you remember our original conclusions, Dr. Gardner...
But that was before.
Precisely, my point.
It seems to me that that's a Puritan attitude taken to the point of obstructionism.
Detective Chief Inspector,
I realize that my position may seem exasperating to you, but the fact is that I find no reason to believe that Mudie suffered any injury to the brain or stomach or intestine other than that caused by the asphyxiation which led to his death. And whether that is helpful to the police or not, that is my belief.
Well, I searched the room where he appears to have died. There's nothing a rope could have been attached to hang him. Is it possible that someone could have stood behind him and pulled the rope up?
Well, it would have had to have been held for 2 or 3 minutes. I've never known of a murder having been committed in that way, have you, Dr. Gardner?
No.
And it does seem to make hard work of it. I mean, why not just strangle him?
That I don't know. But I'm sure we're coming towards a series of events that is at least possible. Though we need just a little more before we can charge them with murder.
That little more wasn't long in coming. The car which Smith had used was finally tracked down to a hire firm. The company had had Mr. Smith recommended to them by a certain Mr. Lay. The car, a small black Ford, had the registration number FGP-101.
Thomas John Lay and Lawrence John Smith, you are charged with the murder of John McMain Mudie on November the 28th last. Thomas John Lay, are you guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
Lawrence John Smith, are you guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
The jury will now be sworn in.
Initially, Buckingham was charged with murder, along with Lay and Smith. But then, before the trial, he was released so that he could be called by the Crown as a witness against the other two. Lay and Smith were each represented separately, Lay's defence being led by Sir Walter Monckton and Gerald Howard, both of them renowned and highly expensive KCs, while Smith's advocates were the rather lesser known Mr. Derek Curtis Bennett and Mr. Malcolm Morris. The prosecution was conducted by Mr. Anthony Hawke, while the case was presided over by no less a figure than the Lord Chief Justice of England, Lord Goddard. Mr. Hawke began by laying out the case for the prosecution and referring to Lay's apparent belief that Mrs. Brooke was being unfaithful.
There appears to be no foundation whatsoever for such a suspicion. But reason, apparently, did not operate with Mr. Lay where Mrs. Brooke was concerned. I say this because he actually accused her of being her son-in-law's mistress, and he made similar accusations about a person named Roma. Why this man should go through this extraordinary performance of sending these 3 cheques to her at Wimbledon is a speculation of some difficulty. And the only assignable object you may think of this action of his was that if Mrs. Brooke had by any chance signed the cheques, it would show that she was visiting and associating with Mudie, either in Wimbledon or in London, behind Lay's back.
Thus did the prosecution outline the apparent actions of Thomas John Lay, some of them with a seemingly logical basis, some with a certain semblance of sense, and some which could only be taken as the actions of a man no longer in control of his mind. Into this last category must come the nature of Lay's jealousy concerning his 66-year-old ex-mistress, Mrs. Brooke. Her landlady, Blanche Evans, was asked by the prosecution about the time Lay had visited her house.
Having told Lay who was there, did he say anything about your tenants?
Yes. I imagine I mentioned Jack Mudie, and he said, Jack, she's always mentioning his name.
Did he say any more about Mudie?
He asked me what kind of man he was. I said he was a very nice man, and so he was.
Did you say anything about Mudie ever meeting Mrs. Brooke?
Yes.
Would you tell my lord and the gentlemen of the jury what?
I introduced him to Mrs. Brooke on the landing outside the bathroom, and he only talked to her for 5 minutes.
Were you there all the time?
Yes, I introduced them.
Did you say that he had met her at any other time?
Not to my knowledge.
Did you tell Lay that?
Yes. He said, they had hijinks at the flat upstairs, he said. And of course, to put it broadly, he said, of course, she couldn't take the pace.
But did all of this amount to proof of murder? The prosecution had a fairly flimsy case. And then, to make things worse, the Director of Public Prosecutions was paid a rather surprising visit by Dr. Keith Simpson.
So you were approached by Mr. Lay's solicitors and invited to change sides?
Yes.
Audacious of them?
Yes. Normally I would have politely declined, but on this occasion, well, I don't wish to stand idly by if there's a danger of miscarriage of justice.
And is there such a danger?
If Dr. Gardner's reinterpretation of events goes unchallenged, then yes, I believe there could be.
Hmm. You were engaged initially by the Surrey police, yes?
I have already spoken to the chief constable of Surrey. He didn't raise any objections.
And you really believe this to be necessary?
I do, yes.
Then I shall raise no objection either.
And so it was that Dr. Simpson prepared to give evidence for the defence. But first, Dr. Gardner was brought to the witness stand.
There was another rather heavier bruise on the front of the hip bone there.
Did you examine his brain?
Yes.
What did you find there?
There were two bruises on the front of the brain. One was on the front and under the surface of this lobe of the brain, and there was another on the front of what we call the temple brain. But, in my opinion, the important observation was that the brain fluid was rather deeply bloodstained.
I was going to ask you on that point. What conclusion did you draw from that?
That there'd been an injury to the head, a blow, a concussion. And I looked upon that blood-stained fluid as due to concussion of some severity.
What about the intestines? Were there signs of injury there?
There was a very deep congestion of the intestines. There was hemorrhage in the stomach, and the mucous membrane of all the intestines was so congested that it looked like crimson velvet.
What does that indicate, that internal bleeding?
Well, I interpreted it as evidence of some violence, such as might have been from a blow in the intestine or a knee.
During life?
I thought so.
Such as with a man after he was beaten up?
Well, I thought it suggested a thoroughly rough house.
Dr. Gardner was then cross-examined by Sir Walter Monckton.
Now, the condition in which you found the brain, is it true that in a case of asphyxia you get some indication of hemorrhage on the surface of the brain?
Well, I mean, I don't quite agree.
If I may put it to you this way, with which you are more familiar than I, Moritz, when he is dealing with this on page 179... in the...
Monckton went on to read from the Pathology of Trauma and other medical tomes, demonstrating that the hemorrhages found in Moody's body were entirely consistent with injury purely from asphyxiation. Counsel for the defence then went on to question Gardner's present view of the precise cause of Moody's death. If the noose had suddenly been jerked or pulled, then that would have indicated murder. A gradual tightening of the noose would be open to other interpretations. Similarly, if Moody could be shown to have been hung, that was likely to lead the jury to believe him unlikely to have been murdered.
When you first went into this matter, did you take the view that the rope marks, which we see there illustrated, indicated that the deceased was suspended by it?
You'll see in my report that the words I used were some degree of suspension.
Did you not say in your original report that there was no doubt the accused was suspended by it, meaning the rope?
I can't remember.
I would be awfully grateful to you if you would.
Well, the mark indicated that there had been some sort of suspension, but there'd been no drop.
You didn't think that he'd been hung in the ordinary sense?
Yes.
Suspension? You mean you could have a man lying on his back and his neck pulled up?
You've put it exactly, my lord.
Was Gardner playing the tune the police wanted to hear, with variations to fit the evidence? Or was he, quite legitimately, reviewing the medical evidence in the light of other material? Dr. Simpson, called to speak for the defence, seems to have been in no doubt. He was determined to state nothing more than the medical evidence would allow.
What about the lie of the marks around the neck?
They were such as is not only commonly seen in suspension, but in my view speak plainly for suspension. In this case, from the left side. There was no mark of jerking or pulling, merely of tightening and suspension. There was nothing on the body to indicate whether this suspension was complete or incomplete.
Was there anything to indicate whether it was accidental or willful strangulation?
There was nothing.
But this body was lying in a trench, in a chalk pit.
Yes, my lord. I am describing the conclusions I draw from this mark. It had been lifted in some way at the left side of the neck. But how? There was nothing to show.
Both Lay and Smith were found guilty of murder. The jury was invited to believe that the unfortunate Moody had been lured to the house of the jealousy-crazed Lay, that a rug had been thrown over him, that he'd been bound and gagged, and then, well, exactly what happened after that was never clearly established, except that he was found dead in a chalk pit with a noose around his neck. But in his summing up, the Lord Chief Justice appealed to the common sense of the jury. He referred to any inference that Moody may have committed suicide, or that his death may have been accidental, as fantasy. Therefore, the death must have been murder. And murder, of course, it may well have been, with or without the contest between the two pathologists over the uses and abuses of medical evidence. But there's a postscript to the story. At the trial, Lay had refused his defence to enter a plea of insanity. But 3 days before he was due to be hanged, Lay was visited by his solicitor.
And what have you come for? To tell me how many hours I've got left? I know how many hours I've got left. Or to give me a bill?
No.
What then?
They've decided you're mad.
Which means?
You're suffering from paranoia. A sort of...
I don't mean what sort of madness. What does it mean for me?
It means you'll live. Given that you were insane at the time of the crime, you're to be sent to Broadmoor Criminal Lunatic Asylum.
My God.
For the rest of your life.
Then, perhaps, believing it harsh in these circumstances to go ahead with the execution of Smith, the authorities also reprieved him and sent him instead for a long term of imprisonment. If Lay was guilty, though there must be still some doubt, was he mad, or was he simply wicked? Or was he perhaps both? We shall never know, for just 2 months after he arrived at Broadmoor, Thomas John Lay had a stroke. He died there the following day.
In The Body in the Chalk Pit, Keith Drinkle played Dr. Keith Simpson and Stephen Thorne played Dr. Eric Gardner. Other parts were played by Barry J. Gordon, Catherine Parr, Jonathan Adams, Philip Anthony, John Webb, Matthew Morgan, John Fleming, and Geraldine Fitzgerald. Murder Most Foul was written by Rib Davis and presented by Nick Ross. The producer was Fiona McLean.